All right, 99.
3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. New episode is posted every Monday for your listening and binging pleasure. I am your humble and lovable host, Elton Jim Toronto. And welcome to episode 99. Yes, 99. TV aficionados will hopefully recognize that imitation of Maxwell Smart, his girlfriend and later wife, and initially his secret agent companion, 99, was a woman, his partner. Yes, 99. Maxwell Smart and 99. I believe 99 did have a name, but they always called her 99. Now, I'll give you a little trivia. I think they may have even said her name one time, but then that was an alias. But I will tell you, I believe, little trivia here, that they also called their boss, who was, yes, chief, his real name was Thaddeus. So there's a little trivia to impress friends at parties. Although, at this point, you probably would be able to impress friends at parties if you just heard of the show Get Smart. And I will always go to my millennial foil here. Jasmine, Jazzy, Ethel, whatever she goes by, Minnie Cooper, the producer here. Jazzy, Ethel, Minnie Cooper.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of the show Get Smart?
Isn't that a movie too?
Yeah, it was a movie, but it was based on a TV show from the 60s.
Oh.
And then Steve Carell was in the movie version.
Yeah, right. I've only seen the movie, but
okay.
I don't remember.
But at least you've heard that term, Get Smart.
Right.
And you had some idea of what it was.
Right.
Yeah, but it was a TV show from the 60s that had a guy named Don Adams, and Barbara Feldon was 99. And so they wound up getting married, but that was her name on the show, 99. So I will dedicate this show to Get Smart since it is episode 99. And so next week, next episode is 100. Wow. I don't know. I'm debating, do I try to do something, you know, big to commemorate it, or do, as I said a couple of weeks ago, follow the Walter Payton adage and just say, hey, number 100, what's the big deal? Of course I'm doing episode 100. I never thought I wouldn't. Walter Payton always, when he scored a touchdown, he didn't spike the ball. He didn't do some big dance. He wasn't doing Michael Jackson's Thriller in the end zone. He just handed the ball to the ref, like, hey. And his thoughts on it was, if you score a touchdown, you should get into the end zone like you've been there before. No big deal. And you will be back again. So I'm debating to do it the cool breeze Walter Payton way, or to commemorate it in some special way. 100. I mean, what is 100? For some reason, we put credibility on 100, which is strange because, of course, if we had adopted the metric system, like 99% of the world has, yes, 99, and I said that on purpose, everything today will have a 99 phrase. You're going to hear 99s quite a bit today. Just give you a little hint there. But like 99% of the world has, and when I was a kid in the 70s, growing up in grammar school, there was a definite plan that we were going to switch to the metric system. And even in schools, they started a program to begin to indoctrinate us. And as anybody knows, the metric system is based, it's much easier than our ridiculous system, which has no basis in anything. You know, why is 12 inches a foot? Why is 212 boiling at Fahrenheit? Makes no sense. Why is 32 freezing? The metric system, so simple, so logical, all based on tens, on factors of 10. 1/10, 10, 10, 10, it's all tens. But, and there, so we even had a TV, we had a closed circuit, I'll never forget this, we had a close every like 2 or 3 days, at least once a week, we would have this closed circuit program that we would watch to try to teach us how to do metric, what a centimeter was, what a kilometer was. And then, you know, don't forget, you know, centimeters and kilowatts, you know, all those little prefixes all then applied to other types of things too. It's a very logical, easy system. But back in the 70s, you know, the United States, you know, we were pounding our chest. There was no such thing as globalization. Back in the 70s, we were America. We don't do what everyone, we don't do what Europe does. We're not doing what someone else does. No, we're America. We're doing 12 inches is a foot. That's what we do. We don't care what the rest of the world does. We had a very, you know, hyped up view of ourselves. And so as much as the government was trying, and there was even for a while on speed limit signs and road signs, there was kilometers on our signs, on our highways. They were trying to slowly indoctrinate people. And as I said, there was a time in this culture when I was young, actually. I was that future that they always keep talking about. You know, they always say, hey, we have to, you know, the future for the kids. We're always talking about the future and the kids. Well, I was that future at one time. So they were like, hey, we have to educate these kids because they're going to be the future. And they'll use the metric system. And we used to watch this closed circuit show. And the character on the show was Metric Man. And Metric Man came on every week, and he was dressed as a superhero with a big M on his chest. And he would tell, I don't know why we needed a Metric Man, but we were kids, and so we needed some kind of a mascot, right? And Metric Man would come, and there would be a daily lesson. And so they were beginning, and then it just faded. I don't know what happened, as I said. You'd drive around and suddenly on road signs, you'd see kilometers or meters, and you would start. And don't forget, why do you think we have today? This makes no sense when you think about it. Why is there a 2-liter bottle of pop? Answer me that. Why is there a 2-liter bottle of pop? We don't use liters. We use gallons. We use pints. We use quarts. You can't buy a quart of pop, can you? Do you go to the grocery store and buy a gallon of pop? No. You buy a two liter or a liter. Why? Because, and this I don't understand. So they were starting to bring in the liters, once again, the liquid measurement in the metric system into our culture. So for some reason they said, hey, you know, pop companies, you guys touch everybody, especially back in the 70s. Everybody drank pop. So they said, hey, why don't we slowly indoctrinate the population and getting them used to using terms of the metric system. And so there was the liter, and now there's the 2-liter bottle. And for some reason, that's never gone away. The 2-liter bottle is still around. Why are we buying pop in liters? We buy cans. Those are ounces. We buy milk in quarts and pints and gallons. But for some reason, pop is still metric. our society absolutely makes no sense. I mean, why? And when we saw that the metric system wasn't happening, why didn't they just, I mean, I think they probably, you know what, probably they probably rejiggered their entire, factories to build these new bottles. They bought into the metric system. And then 5 years later, it wasn't catching on, and Americans were saying, we're not going metric. No, we are not. And that whole, suddenly, Metric Man, we didn't see Metric Man anymore. we thought he was invincible, but clearly our system was his kryptonite, and he's gone. Metric Man shriveled up, all his muscles shrunk, and he was gone out of American society. And what was left? The 2-liter pop bottle. That's all we have of our memories of Metric Man. So, anyway, I just got a flashback of the metric system. But yeah, we, back then we were like, no, we're not doing any metric stuff. Now, I don't even know why I started on the metric system. I'm looking at my notes. Metric system is nowhere on the page. Just did a 10-minute rant on the metric system and had no idea. That's what I love about this podcast. As much as I think I'm in the driver's seat, this thing is really a self-driving podcast. I'm in the back seat. It's just going along, taking left turns and right turns wherever it wants. Hopefully it's not hitting anybody, like I talked about a few weeks ago. But here's what I wanted to talk about this week, because it has something to do, once again, with our adapting to and taking on new behaviors, like we rejected the metric system. Although I do want to, I'm going to look that up. Why do we still have 2-liter bottles? I know I sound like George Carlin. Why do we have 2-liter bottles? Or I sound like Jerry Seinfeld. What is with the 2-liter bottles? Why do we have them? I don't know. But here's the thing that that I found over the last couple of weeks. Once again, I've talked about technology on this podcast many times, and don't get me wrong. I mean, some of it is exaggerated. Of course, I partake in the technology revolution, and I've taken you along for my ride. As I told you about a year and a half or 2 years ago when I started this podcast, I was not streaming. And about 6 or 8 months ago, I was kind of feeling like maybe I need to start, streaming, getting into the streaming world. There were so many TV shows I was missing. And now, a few months ago, I bought my Amazon Fire Stick, and now I'm streaming. Just watched a little House of Cards the other night. Zip, zip. Just nothing on the regular television. Went on, and what's so great about this Fire Stick, it's got Alexa in it, which I always made fun of. What do you need Alexa for? It's stupid. I could find out what time it is by looking at my watch. I don't need to ask Alexa what to do. But here I am going, broop, broop, House of Cards. Broop, and there it is. So I've dipped my toe in, at times my entire foot. I've even gone up to the ankle. I'm not afraid to say it. And I'm not afraid to say there may be a time where I go up to the calf, at least mid-calf. Now, I don't know if I'm going to go micro-mini. I may never go over the knee or higher. But I'm willing to go mid-calf, sure, into the technology pool. But over the last couple of weeks, once again, a cautionary tale here, folks, which we can all learn from. And sadly, we have to learn from other people's sabotaging mistakes. I've said there is no question that technology has helped us and will continue to help us. And there's no doubt, as I said, I do Facebook. I know I joke, but come on. I mean, I don't take pictures of my food. I don't put selfies up every 2 seconds of where I was at. I use it more as kind of a marketing tool, like for this podcast and for other things that I do. But and I'll put up some personal stuff every so often. But I'll tell you one thing I don't have, and that's my little rant here. I do have, in fact, I do have a Twitter account, but I've never used it. When I first started here at WGN back in 2009, the producer of our show, you know, Twitter was just beginning to really catch steam. And so our producer said, hey, do you guys want a Twitter account for yourselves? And so I said, yeah, you might as well make one for me. You know, so he made one for me, and I gave him a password at the time 9 years ago. But I don't remember what the password is. And I never really used Twitter when it first started because I was like, you know, it's, I don't need that. And then it quickly got corrupted. Ideally, as I said many times, on the whiteboard, very cool idea. You know, you have X amount of characters. It doesn't have to be some long, big thing. And you throw that out there, and it's a way to get your voice heard, and you can connect with people, and people can follow you. And yeah, it sounded great. And then quickly, it got corrupted by the human element, as I've always said. It looks good on a whiteboard until people get involved. And suddenly it became monetized, and it became, you know, celebrities got on there because it was cool to get on. But then they hired people, and they still do. I got news for you. You know, Brad Pitt is not getting up every day tweeting. If he has a Twitter account, he's probably hired someone to write something. Most celebrities who have Twitter accounts don't even write their own tweets. So it's been bastardized and it's been monetized, and it is what it is. But I'll tell you what it still is from what it was at the beginning. It could be a very dangerous tool, as we've seen the last couple of weeks here. The most recent self-inflicted wound. There's nothing worse than a self-inflicted wound, folks. It's tough enough to get by without getting hurt by the world around you. Don't hurt yourself. That's the goal. You got to be on the lookout for someone else hurting you, but by all means, make sure you keep yourself safe from yourself. But Twitter can shoot you right in the foot, and it does it with no regret. So I say this because I've seen in the news the last couple of weeks, and it's more of a cautionary tale. I know everybody wants to feel cool and feel hip and feel involved and feel connected and all that, but as I've sort of proselytized this, you can still be part of it without getting totally immersed and having a little of your own self instead of sharing everything all the time with everyone. Because you can get in trouble. And that's what happened this last couple of weeks. There's this commentator on Fox News called Laura Ingraham. And, you know, this is not about her in terms of whether you like her or not. I don't care whether you like her or not. All I'm saying is here's somebody who has been around for a while. Educated woman, political pundit, blogger, internet, podcasts. Her goal was to get her own show on a cable network. That was her goal. She had one many years ago, but it wasn't prime time. But about 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, she finally gets her shot. She gets a TV show called The Ingraham Angle. And it's prime time. It's right between Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity. And wow. Okay, you got... I'm just looking at it from an objective view of here's a person who worked hard to get something, and she got it. Here's her shot. And now, that shot, she shot right in her foot. Did it herself. I'm sure you heard about this. One of the students from the Parkland, Florida shooting in the school, this guy Daniel Hogg, I think his name is. And he's one of the, you know, one of the more active and, you know, well-known kids who went to the school, who was there when the shooting happened, who have become activists and sort of become, you know, spokespeople for the kids. And they had the big rally several weeks ago about gun control. And so these kids have, you know, a lot of these kids, and this, including this kid, has been raised into a media figure now. And he's on all the TV shows and that. So, of course, you know, Laura Ingraham on Fox, she's a conservative, and so she's anti-gun control, and so she's looking with a raised eyebrow at these young liberal kids. I'm sure she's calling them. And so, you know, let's face it, Twitter is a place for opinions, and people can get snarky. And we've seen the President of the United States use Twitter to both his advantage and his disadvantage. Advantage is that it helped him become president. Disadvantage, it's helping to dismantle his presidency. But one way or the other, it's been a valuable tool. And I guarantee, as much as people give Trump a hard time about all his tweets, the context of them, he has changed the game. And every political candidate, presidential candidate from now on, is going to use Twitter, and every president is going to use Twitter. Now, whether they use it to the extent that Trump uses it, and with some of the recklessness that he's used it with, we'll see. But there's no question that using Twitter by Trump was a very shrewd move. The reason why the media hates Trump's tweets is because he circumvented the media. Media used to be the conduit for the president's message to get to the people. Trump was afraid that the media was going to corrupt his message because they didn't like him. So he took the middleman out and went, jumped over them, leapfrogged them, and talked right to the people via Twitter. You can like him or not. Shrewd move. And, as I said before, game changer. All future presidents are going to use Twitter. Guaranteed. Guarantee you. But anyway, we've seen the bad things that has happened for Trump, putting these kind of tweets out without really thinking, and just whatever's on his mind, hitting, you know, send, and off it goes. So here's Laura Ingraham. Didn't need to, I mean, right now, you know, there's this idea of is something too soon? The Parkland thing is still fresh in people's mind. You just had this huge rally around the country, especially in Washington, D.C., where all these kids were there and they were speaking their mind and they were all passionate about gun control, especially the ones who went to the school like this kid. And I don't know if his name is Daniel or David now. I feel bad. David Hogg. And so here she comes completely on her own. Word came out, this kid's a senior in high school. He applied to some colleges, and he got rejected by four colleges, West Coast colleges. Now, don't forget, Laura Ingraham is a Dartmouth graduate, okay? So she's got a very prestigious education behind her. And so here she is kind of using her own pedigree, her own degree from Dartmouth, as well as her anti, you know, gun control, to pick on this 17-year-old kid and saying, ha ha, you got rejected from four schools. You and your 4.1 grade point average weren't good enough to get into these schools. What are you picking on this kid for? I mean, unnecessary, but she figured, you know, it plays into her kind of persona as this right-wing. And we're going to try to put down the left at every shot. But she went after some, you know, 17, 18-year-old kid who had just been through a very traumatic thing. So he's got the public on his side. But despite that, here's where the story twists, which is really interesting. You know, this kid's 17 years old. You can argue that she kind of bullied him. So you'd expect a 17-year-old high school student to act like a 17-year-old high school student who got bullied in recess on the playground, right? And come back with some snarky remark about Laura Ingraham. But if one thing that the internet and all these different kind of social media services have done with our youth. Yeah, you know, they use it for silliness and, you know, but it's made them very savvy to some extent. At least this kid, David Hogg, he didn't say, oh, Laura Ingraham's ugly, or strike back at her on some personal level. He was smart. He responded by retweeting her tweet about what she said about him, and then said, if you don't think that was nice or that was right, he urged all of her TV show sponsors to drop her show. And within a couple of days, more than a dozen sponsors bailed out of Laura Ingraham's show because they didn't want to be on the wrong side of this Parkland survivor's story and on the wrong side of those who support him. She thought that she could bully some 17-year-old kid and with some snarky little comment that would come and go. Or she would get him involved in some little, as I said before, little silly playground. He said, she said, and he'd come back, oh, yeah, well, you're dumb, or you're ugly, or you're this, or you're that, and come back with some little stupid remark that she could then make more fun of him about. But he outsmarted her. He outsmarted the Dartmouth graduate because he's savvy with social media. So now her job is in jeopardy. Her show is in jeopardy. She worked many years to get that job, and she finally got it. As I said, like her or not, you have to admire her ambition and her drive and her goal. She had a goal, and she got it. And what did she do? She self-sabotaged. There was no need to go after this kid at all. But she did. And this is my point. I know Twitter is tempting. And we all now have this urge or this feel to say everybody has an opinion. We've always had opinions. We just never had the forum to exert them like we do now. But remember, this is not just a letter that you write to a specific person. Or this is not just a comment that you make within your small group of friends. Twitter goes to the whole world, literally. Laura Ingraham shot herself in the foot for no reason. You could do the same thing. You could say something about either a big topic or a personal topic that might get you in trouble with your family or your friends or could jeopardize your job as well. That's happened to many people. Regular civilians, if you will, people that are not in the media, people that aren't making $1 million a year. But they go on and they make some comment and somehow it gets viral, somehow it gets picked up, and an average person can lose their job by saying something that people either misinterpret or saying something that's just plain stupid that they should have kept to themselves. So I would just say resist this thing. Like I said, I've got this Twitter account. I've never used it. Now, obviously, I like to share my opinions. What do you think I'm doing here right now? But I like to share them when I have control of it and when I've got my own thoughts in line. And so much of Twitter, as we've seen with Trump especially, is off the cuff and it gets you in trouble. Here's my little, you know, so I would just urge people to take a step, take a deep breath. Believe me, even on my little Facebook page, there's sometimes something happens like, boy, I really want to make a comment. And I've gone to the point of even typing it out and writing it and even finding a picture on the internet to add a visual aspect to it so people will look at it and see it and the whole thing. And before I hit post, I read it one more time. And I take my hands away from the computer. I sit on my hands. So nothing will hit that button. And I read it over and I read it over and I read it over and I say, is there any way that this could be misinterpreted or not send the message that I am delivering because someone may not have a knowledge of this topic or the context in which I am sending it? And if it doesn't pass those tests, you know what? I go, you know what? yeah, this would make me feel good for these couple of seconds. And yeah, I think this is a good topic to throw out into the world, but you know what? It might not be worth it. Because really, think about how silly it is. Has this ever happened to you? Have you ever gotten into a social media kind of argument with somebody, like on Facebook or something, where you go back and forth? How silly is that, really? When you take a step back, how silly. What a waste of time. Half the time you're talking to somebody you don't even know. And you're trying to convince them of something that you're not going to. And you're going back and forth. I get a kick out of my Facebook page. Sometimes I post something, which is, in my mind, relatively benign. And then someone will comment on it in a way I never would have expected. And then another person will see it on my page and will argue with that person. And this argument will happen between two people on my Facebook page, of which I have no control over. It's a waste of time, folks. Take a step back. Another side of Twitter. Everybody, what the internet has really done to the world has made our entire world high school. We are all basically, I would say, the whole world has been turned into a sophomore or junior in high school. We're not exactly freshmen. We're not exactly that naive and that, you know, new to the world. We're not newbies. But we're not seniors, because we're not really, you know, as mature as we should be. We're right in the middle. We're like sophomores. We're going in. We just finished sophomore year, going into junior year. So we've got a little wind behind our sail. We're thinking we're pretty cool. We're not seniors yet. We're not that cool, but we're getting there. We're not frosh soft anymore. So we think we're cool. And that's, I think, the whole world in general is. We're basically sophomores becoming juniors, because the whole world now is a high school. That's what Twitter has, and the social media has really done to our culture. It's made us all into one giant high school, because all we're worried about today are likes on Facebook, followers on Twitter, right? Likes and followers. That's what we want. We need that. And views on YouTube. Views, likes, and followers. What does that sound like? Sounds like high school. You want to be liked? You want people to see you and notice you? And you want people to follow you and be in your little clique, don't you? That's high school. So that's what this is. We've become a global high school. And once again, self-sabotage to people's careers. I'm just using these as a couple of media examples, because they're most recent and they're very obvious and they're very clear. In the media especially, it's important, either in your own self of your own ego, or perhaps because sadly a lot of employers, especially in the media, they love to talk about, well, this person has this many views or this many followers. So, I mean, I don't know. In today's world, and bosses are even looking at this. Is that some kind of measuring stick? So, sadly, two well-established media personalities right here in the Chicago area got caught trying to inflate their Twitter accounts. One well-known columnist, a movie reviewer for the Chicago Sun-Times, Richard Roper, got caught trying to buy followers to inflate his Twitter following. So he looked like he had more followers than he did. What was the self-sabotage there? Well, first of all, if you're in the media, your credibility and your trust with your audience is what you have. That's your value. If you do anything to harm your credibility or your trust, you're dead. The irony with Richard Roper was he had just got reinstated as a daily or weekly columnist. So he just got promoted and was going to have a chance to have a little more exposure, a little more influence. And then this came up and they immediately still writing movie reviews, but in terms of being a columnist to talk about politics or pop culture or whatever, that was taken immediately away. Self-sabotage. Didn't need to buy these fake followers, but for his own, I don't know, his own ego? Or, once again, some measuring stick? Or be able to tell people at a party how many followers you have? I don't know. But for some reason, he paid for fake followers to inflate his Twitter account. And he's hurt his credibility as a journalist, which is huge. And he also hurt his status. He lost a really nice gig. Another one, most recently, Chicago Tribune cartoonist Scott Stantis, who I know personally. He actually put me in one of his cartoons about 2 years ago. He got caught doing the same thing. His job is to comment on everything and create a bond with the reader, that they can trust him, that they like his take on things, his humor, his perspective, his credibility, and his trust. Once again, that is at the core of every journalist, the trust that you have built with your audience. But when you're buying under the table, when you're buying fake followers so that you can inflate your Twitter account, you've hurt and severely damaged your trust. Now, they both have kept their jobs, which is great, especially in this climate when media jobs are at a premium, and especially in the newspaper world. But they really damaged themselves, and that's the key. They damaged themselves. They didn't need to do it, but there was this pressure internally or externally, not sure where it came from, maybe a bit of both. But that's where we're in now. We're in this kind of high school mentality of, I want to be cool. I want people to think I'm cool. So I'm going to go on Twitter and say these things so I'll be cool with people, like Laura Ingraham, and it came back to shoot her in the foot and greatly damaged. She may lose her show. If she doesn't lose her show, she certainly now has a black mark on her. And as I said, Roper and Stantis severely damaged their reputations and the trust that they built with their audiences by falsifying. We in the media, we're supposedly there to point out the things that are false out there. We're not supposed to be the problem. We're supposed to point out the problem. But that is our Twitterverse now, and that's the things that people succumb to. So all I would say in terms of Twitter, folks, here's a little phrase. Write it down, put it in your purse, put it on your wallet, tattoo it on your Twitter hand. If someone can misread it, delete it. That's what you need to do. Take a step back, read what you just wrote on Twitter. And if you feel, this is awesome and this is going to be great, but then say, wow, if someone disagrees, could they turn this on me? Or if they don't know the context of what I'm talking about, are they going to look at me in a different way than I want them to think of me? Sometimes I've written some benign things on Facebook that are just kind of a little quick little joke. And people come back with a perspective on that comment that I had no idea. I was even, wow, where did that come from? And I've learned my lesson. So if someone can misread it, delete it. And welcome back to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. And now we take a little stroll to the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Jim.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Are you back from all your skiing trips and Deer Valley and your... What else? We found...
my general gallivanting.
You're gallivanting, you're bon vivanting, you're... trying to find Pepito. My goodness, yes. What a life. Yes. I remember a young Emily Arminetti. She came into my office, 98? 97? 99. So almost 20 years ago, she had this big smile, and she had all this drive and ambition, and she was just wondering what her future would be like. And 20 years later, I'm not trying to get, you could certainly just, take the fifth on this, but in the last 20 years, are you happy with what's happened?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I don't mean, I guess now I don't want to say that because that's an easy yes question.
Oh.
Are you doing what you, as 20 years ago, as you sit where you are now with everything that's going on, is that where you expected to be or did you expect something else?
Oh, definitely not. But I mean, I when I left Chicago, we worked together for Fizz, and then I left Chicago to move to London.
Right.
And since then, I lived over there for a long time. Well, much longer than I expected. I was there for almost 7 years. And then I've also lived, in Washington, D.C. and New York and, now Austin. And no, I definitely did not expect any of that. And I think that my life ended up being more interesting than I thought it was going to be when I was all those many years ago when I was,
Oh, well, that's good.
Just starting out and yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, wait another 10 years.
Not that I thought, I thought I would, I would live in Chicago. I would build my career.
Right,
and settle
down
and get married and have kids and all that. But I didn't know that my life would end up being as adventurous as it has ended up being. So
that's cool.
That's a good thing, right?
Well, that's nice. Yeah. That's a good thing. Like I said, wait another 10 years. We'll see. I want to hear.
What's
going to happen? I've moved 17 times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we haven't done a pop culture with Emily. So I thought this will be a nice kind of little thing here because it's an amazing. We talked about as I said many times, it pays to listen on a regular basis to this podcast because we will frequently bring up topics that we've spoken about in the past when there's something new and interesting to add to them. And several months ago, we were talking about this new trend going on, especially in television. It's been going on in the movie business for a while, about reunions or rebooting previously done properties. And at that time we were talking about TV shows, like they're bringing back Will and Grace. And we had just mentioned the fact that, they are going to put together a reunion of Roseanne, the popular TV show in the 90s with Roseanne Barr and John Goodman, Sarah Gilbert, many others, Laurie Metcalf. And, who knew what was going to happen? Well,
yeah,
we know what happened. Now, tell the fans what happened.
Well, last week Roseanne. The 10th season of Roseanne.
Yeah, I don't know how if they're counting. Do they count this as a continuation?
Well, I think that's what they're saying. But in any case, so they came back with their premiere of their new season all these years later. And they had over 18 million viewers.
Yeah.
Which is massive.
The biggest premiere of any show on any network.
Yeah. I mean, that's mad. That's getting to me. Somebody told me that they got higher ratings than the Oscars. I don't know. I can't remember exactly what the Oscar ratings are. But this is certainly way up there for a sitcom, for sure. I mean, usually TV events, like something that's an annual thing like the Oscars or the Super Bowl get kind of to this level of ratings and beyond. But this is pretty huge for them. So
well, not only that.
Official. Oh, and I think the very next day, ABC announced that they were going to be renewing it for a second reboot season or whatever we want to call this.
Yeah. I mean, so after one episode, they got renewed. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, now obviously the network has probably seen all the new episodes, so they can see that what the quality of the show is. But based on, like you just said, based on this very impressive premiere of 18 million people, which ironically was higher, that those 18 million viewers were higher than the 16 million that watched the Roseanne finale.
Oh, right. Yeah.
When it first went off the air back in the, you know, the late night. I mean, so, I mean, wow. I mean, this, and to think, if many people, I don't know if they know the story, but the impetus for this reunion was very happen chance and very spur of the moment. Sarah Gilbert is one of the hosts on the talk, one of the TV shows on CBS. And John Goodman came on as a guest, and she said, why don't we do a little skit with, you know, Dan Connor and her character? And they did it, and it went well. It was kind of funny. It was a short little skit. And in the midst of that, when it was done, it got such a positive reaction. And as I was talking about earlier in the show, it got many views, which is very important today. And so Sarah says to Goodman, hey, if I tried to put together a Roseanne reunion show, would you be interested? And he's like, yeah, I would, Roseanne.
Oh, wow. That was a really good John Goodman.
Yeah, you know what? It was so funny. I didn't even know I could do John Goodman. Hey, Roseanne.
Wow.
Hey, Roseanne.
Are that almost, that sounds like you're hitting a button.
No, that's me. That, no, no. Hey, Roseanne. No, I could actually talk to myself and talk to John Goodman if I want. Hey, Roseanne. I discovered that on the Bill and Wendy show. I was filling in one time with Bill, and for some reason we were talking about John Goodman, and I just said, hey, Roseanne. And he did the same thing you did. He went, whoa, that was, I said, you know, I didn't even know I could do John Goodman.
Right. And, see, this is good because now you have reason to do your John.
Yeah. Now John Goodman is one of my only impressions of someone who is still alive. So I'm very excited about that. But now I have to find out.
It'll be this is now also going to be a reboot of your John Goodman.
Yeah. Now I'm going to start doing. I'm going to start doing John Goodman quite often now. Hey, Roseanne. But. But you know what? I was throwing that out there, and I'm so happy that you liked it, because I was like, you know, I haven't done it in a while, but now I have reason to do my John Goodman. I actually met him several years ago when he was doing The Babe. I interviewed him. I went out to Wrigley Field when they were making the movies 20-some years ago. But anyway. Hey, Roseanne. So, but yeah, so he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then they got Roseanne, and they got Whitney Cummings, the you know, who's behind Two Broke Girls, and she had her own show. She's a very hot comedian, and I guess they got a lot of the original, all the original cast, and a lot of the people even behind the scenes. They had fun with the two Beckys.
Yeah, well, they say that Sarah Gilbert was personally responsible for getting all of the members of the cast to agree to come back and do this.
Yeah, it was her.
So, and she's also an executive producer, I think, on this.
Yeah, it was her idea, like I said.
But she reached out to each and every one of them to say, hey, we're thinking about doing this. This person's on board. This person's on board. Would you do it? You know?
Yeah, well, as soon as she got John Goodman to say, yeah, I'll do it. Then she had, yeah, I'll do it.
Oh, Lord, what have we done?
Hey, Roseanne.
Here we go.
Hey, Roseanne. So, then that gave her some, some heft, no pun intended, to go to Roseanne and to go to Laurie Metcalf. I mean, especially at this point, Laurie Metcalf is an Oscar nominee. She doesn't need to come back and do a TV show. You know, some of the other people are probably, you know, the kid that plays, DJ is probably happy about this, but Laurie Metcalf doesn't need the job.
Right.
And so, they've done a couple of episodes. The first one was very politically charged, and which brings me to my point is that it's really funny how this show seems to be, it's certainly they've recaptured the pacing and the same kind of blue-collar humor and the self-deprecating humor that they're just struggling along, and they're kind of white trash, and they admit it, and they're proud of it, and they're not happy about it, but they've embraced it, And that was always the charm of Roseanne.
They're
Roseanne.
Not putting up any airs.
Right.
They're not trying to be anything they're not.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there was an extra little political kind of thing, because in real life, actually, Roseanne is a Trump supporter, and she brought that in, and that's become a little kind of a source for storylines and comedy. But it really does seem that that it really is – it's the right time, because if you look at – you know, so many of the shows on television, when they are portraying life, a lot of, you know, an average family, a lot of it is that idealized view of a family, you know, mixed race and, you know, a kid with a disability. It's like we try to get every kind of group. You know, there's a show now with Zach Braff, Alex Inc., and you look at the thing, and now he's married to an Indian woman, and they've got, you know, everybody, you know, there's a show Blackish, you know, every show has to have, you know, This Is Us, we've got this, we've got that, and hey, even Roseanne has a transgender character and an African-American character in the as a part of the family. So they've certainly done that, but as I said, they've really went back to the basics of the like you said, they've kind of embraced it and haven't put on any airs. And it would seem, obviously, I'm just wondering, you know, is the show, does the show have legs, or was it a curiosity factor, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, bringing it back, that was going to be, that, I guess, was promoted as a kind of a TV event, you could say. So I'm sure that gave it a little bit of a ratings boost. But even this, like, so the second episode aired, what, you know, well, it's last night in real time for us, but by the time it's posted, it'll be, you know, a little bit, a week ago.
Right.
And even the ratings for that show, I think they had over 15 million viewers. And so that's still really good. And, by the way, they gave the middle a ratings boost.
Yeah,
The middle is like the little sitcom that could.
Right.
You know, like nobody, you never meet anyone who ever watches it, although you and I really like it.
Oh, I do. I always watch the middle.
I've been watching it for a long time, but I never meet anyone who ever watches it. And it's like recently I saw some people on TV talking about it, and they were saying, like, the middle, what is that? You know, and it's a really good show. It's very funny. It's Patricia Heaton, and it's a, you know, family-oriented
Yeah, unfortunately for them, though, now this is their farewell season. I wonder if they're going to re...
Well, this is their last season. That's the thing. Yeah, now all of a sudden Roseanne comes along and gives them a ratings boost. It's like, go figure.
But, you know. I mean, and now, when we said this, even before the Roseanne, you know, idea was even hatched several months ago, when the first prospect came, when they even when they were talking about Will and Grace, before Will and Grace came on, and that's become a hit for NBC, we both talked about that if these reboots, if some of these reboots hit, that's all you will see. And as soon, within that first couple of days after the Roseanne thing, suddenly I see Helen Hunt talking about I'm Mad About You.
Oh boy, yeah, that would be interesting.
And so now, we're going to be rating all of the, you know, and I don't even remember. I mean, is it going to be have to be a 15 or 20 year show? They may bring back shows that were canceled 5 years, because now in our collective memories, we don't even remember anything from 5 years ago.
Yeah, right. Well, so, and I also think in terms of the longevity, I mean, ratings are one thing, right? But also, you know, it comes down to the quality of the writing. And like Will and Grace is a perfect example. They brought it back. I've watched the entire season so far. I think the Will and Grace reboot is funnier even than the original. And I was a big fan of the show back when it originally aired. But they've done such a great job of just coming back, revisiting these characters, checking in with them and where they're at in their lives now. They've got the same writers. It is still just as funny, if not funnier. And they've done a great job of showing where these people are at in the context of the world today versus 10 or 15 years ago when they were on. And I think already, I mean, Roseanne's only been on for two episodes, but I, you know, I watched both episodes. I don't know what you thought, but I think that the show is just as funny as it was.
Yeah, yeah.
If it continues to be as funny throughout the rest of the season, then I think it'll be here to stay. And obviously, they're already coming back for another one next year. But I think the quality of the writing, at least I can say for Will and Grace, because I think enough episodes have aired now, you know, if that's there, then I think they can be just as successful as they were the first time around.
Yeah, I have no problem. Like I said, I think they did a good job. They you know, with Roseanne especially, they changed very little. The house, the set is the same. The characters are the, you know, there's enough sameness about them, and yet they are 15 or 20, you know, whatever it's been, down the line. So they're not completely the same. I mean, now, you know, Roseanne and Dan keep talking about themselves being grandparents, and they're relishing and actually enjoying the fact that their kids are either trying to be good parents, and they're seeing how they're failing. So they've done a good job.
And this is the stroke of genius about how they've set this up, though, having Darlene move back into their home with her children through a set of circumstances, some of which I think they've talked about, some of which seem like they haven't quite revealed yet. But that is a stroke of genius because, number one, Darlene has always been one of the strongest characters on the show. You know, she kind of had that real sarcastic edge
right.
to her. And so even back when she was, you know, younger, she was a child and a kind of tween and then a teenager, she was always one of the funniest and one of the stronger characters on the show. So now they've got her, and she's actually under the roof. And I think that that was a stroke of genius on behalf of the writers.
Yeah, no, know? No, they've done, like I said, and the pacing is the same. The jokes are the same in terms of the, you know, the self-deprecating and, you know, the middle embracing, as we said before. So, no, they've done a very good job. And clearly, in terms of, like I said before, the climate, you know, you can't deny that, you know, there's been, you know, everybody's talking about, the you know, the unheard middle class and, you know, the Trump kind of voter. And so here's a show that may appeal to them. So they've done a great job. I guess my only fear, and I'm not, you know, they said I never was a big Will and Grace fan, so I haven't seen that. But when I start hearing about it, I guess my only fear as an observer of this, and as a TV fan, is just that it does really cut to the heart of any originality. We are now just going to be, as network television especially sees those numbers, and it is fighting for its life against so many of the streaming services now, as well as cable.
Mm-hmm.
When they see a chance to find a trend, as we've seen with reality television. The irony is that 20 years ago, there were no scripted shows, and it was all reality. Now, they see that a scripted show is popular, and they're going to go do more scripted shows. Even if they're 20 years old, they're going to go and they're going to have less reality shows and more old scripted shows. So once again, they are just following where the trends are, because they're trying to fight for their lives and survival. And I guess my view as a fan of television is I give them kudos for doing a good job on bringing back Roseanne, but it's still Roseanne. So now there's a half hour a week of a show that we have already seen before for 10 years, and now it's back again, and that's fine, but my point is it's taking up a half hour of potentially something new and different. Sadly, many of the new shows are not very good.
Taking up a half an hour of another dull, boring reality TV show.
Oh, yeah.
The Bachelor.
So I guess I just
it that way too.
Yeah, I'm just I guess bemoaning the fact that there's so between. You know, I don't view reality shows as original shows. To me, that's a wasteland. And as I'm saying, I'm just looking for reality. The interesting thing, right in the midst of this whole Roseanne renaissance, one of TV's most popular and successful TV creators in the 70s and 80s was a guy named Stephen Bochco. And he just passed away. He was 74 years old. He died of leukemia. And here's a guy that it started in the early 70s writing some scripts for Columbo. And he wound up in the late 70s and mid 80s. He won 10 Emmy Awards, which is a boatload, and he was responsible for some of the most important and influential and successful TV shows of the last, you know, 30, 35, 40 years. Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue, L.A. Law, Doogie Howser, even Murder One.
Yeah.
Murder One was his later on. And the funny thing is, these were all original shows, and as I was thinking about it today, and I'm seeing some of the shows, that these new shows that have just come on, I don't think a show like Hill Street Blues or NYPD Blue could even get on network television today.
No.
They're too real. They're too real. And not everybody in the cast is out of, you know, Vanity Fair or Vogue magazine. There's a TV show. I haven't seen it because I can't even imagine how horrible it is. There's some lawyer show called All for One. All for the People. Have you seen a commercial on ABC for this show?
No.
But it is basically like seven Vogue models as lawyers.
Or attorneys.
Yeah, as lawyers. It's ridiculous. And I'm sitting there going, and, you know, L.A. Law was a great show. It was funny. It was dramatic. There was great acting. Yeah, there were some sex symbols on that show. Don't get me wrong. But there was a mix of older.
He was on that show, right? Harry Hamlin.
Yeah, Harry Hamlin. Susan. Yeah, Harry Hamlin, Susan Day. Corbin Burnson had hair. I mean, you know. But this legal show looks just like it was made from a cookie cutter, where they said, okay, we have to have the young African American looking guy, good looking guy, good looking woman. You know, it was just right out of central casting. I'm like, there's another show called, like, it's like a female fireman show. Have you seen the coming attraction for that?
No.
Yeah, it's a female firefighter. So, okay, we love firefighters, but we have to have a female, so let's have a female firefighter, and yet all you see is her making out with people, you know?
Well, yeah.
And it's, I'm like, what the hell is this? I mean, you know, it brings a whole, you know, connotation of, you know, her carrying a hose, but that's another subject.
Right.
But I'm just like, I'm thinking back when I saw the Stephen Pochko obituary, I looked at some of the shows he said. I'm like, Hill Street Blues was very gritty. It was even, if you remember, even the look of it was kind of dirty.
Well, NYPD Blues is like that too.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, that's what I mean. It was very gritty and very realistic. And I mean, you know, the Sipowicz character by Dennis Franz, but, you know, Hill Street Blues had, remember Belker was he used to bite people. That character, you know, and then they had their sex symbol. That Ed Marinaro was on there, and Daniel J. Travante and Victoria Hamill were, like, you know, there was definitely that aspect. Every show has that. Don't get me wrong, but there were some real biting and serious topics, and the look of the show wasn't all shiny and glistening and color coordinated, and that was then. It's like, it's so funny, instead of progressing now, maybe, you know, at the same time, cable television has certainly pushed more of that, like True Detective and shows like that. So, but I'm just thinking, network shows, it seems like they are really going for just the most common denominator. And it's amazing how TV was more, you would think that in today's world, TV, network TV, would be more adventurous, but it seems like 30 or 40 years ago it was more adventurous, and there's shows that were on then that probably can never get on now.
Well, yeah, but like you said, they're all scrambling to figure out how to keep up with these changing platforms that are emerging as even more popular than network TV. So, you know, they kind of have to grapple with that and figure out what's going to work.
Yeah. Well, like I said,
the reboots are one part of that. But
yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see now, because the floodgates are open, and I think you're just going to start. I mean, I'm really worried that we're going to get a Family Matters reunion. I don't care what Urkel's up to.
Right.
I don't care.
Are you kicking off no Urkel's campaign?
You know that Facts of Life. Oh, you know Urkel. That Facts of Life is coming back. You know it.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I guarantee you.
I don't know.
Blair and Joe are pitching NBC right now. If they can pull Mrs. Garrett's probably 105.
Is she still alive? I think she's still alive.
Think Charlotte Ray is still alive, and she is still not married, and she is going to still be a nursemaid to those women. They're going to all be divorced, and they're all going to have to live in one house and take care of Mrs. Garrett, who has Alzheimer's. I guarantee you that's the storyline.
Well, one thing's for sure. I don't think they'll be bringing the Cosby Show back. think well, that's I don't, be and a don't, busy with other things.
Don't be too but. Sure about that.
You do a terrible Bill Cosby. Do you stick with John Goodman?
I brought you into this world. I'll take you out. Jell-O pudding.
A Jell-O pudding. now you're really grasping at straws.
Well, we will see what goes on with Roseanne if the show certainly has has some legs but we already know it's coming back next year. So wow, talk about as I said, here was this little skit for 2 minutes on a TV show that was just kind of a nice little reunion thing. How fun! Oh, Sarah Gilbert with John Goodman, how funny is that? And they're dressed in the same way and blah blah blah, and it turns out to be this amazing. Reboot and success. So you never know what's going to happen. But my only fear is that we are going to really start rating,
rating the vol.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all what's going to happen is that all executives, TV executives, are going to go on Netflix and just start reading off into their Alexa. They're just going to read off titles and whatever show pops up. That might not be bad. Are at least 3 or 4 people still alive from that show? Let's get it on.
Yeah.
But it all started with Sarah Gilbert asking John Goodman if he'd be interested in a Roseanne reunion, and he said, yeah, I'd do it. I had to get the John Goodman back in there one more time.
Had to get another one in.
All right, Emily, we'll talk to you later then. Thanks for thanks for coming on the show, Emily. This is John Goodman saying goodbye. And,
thanks, John.
What'd you say?
I said, thanks, John.
Oh, thank you, Emily, for talking about my show in such a good way. Appreciate it. Hey, Roseanne. Bye-bye, Emily.
Bye.
Yeah, this is John Goodman with Elton Jim Toronto's. Filling in for Elton Jim Toronto today. This is John Goodman saying goodbye. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I ain't here in business. I'm only here for fun, Roseanne. I hope you had a good time. We did, too, talking about Roseanne and some other stuff. This is Elton Jim Toronto. It's Captain Podtastic. It's the only website or podcast from the end of the web to your screen. Hi, Roseanne.